I'm honored to have been invited to be part of this session, especially because I'm here not because I'm an expert in homelessness and home insecurity, but to set the social justice context for our discussions. I actually am expert on the social determinants of health and social determinants of equity with a focus on the impacts of racism on the health and well-being of the nation. So what I'm going to do is kind of contextualize different levels of health intervention first, and we're going to think about homelessness when we think about intervening at all of these levels. Then I'm going to turn very briefly to defining racism, and then many of you might be familiar with my gardener's tale allegory, so I'm not going to repeat that, but I can at the end during the question session. But so many of you are familiar with it, but what I will do is share three new allegories that haven't been published yet. So, and they're sort of rough and ready to, you know, I mean, you can help me polish them, but that will help us understand not only racism, but racism as one of many systems of structured inequity that lead to homelessness and home insecurity. So, this is a cartoon animation in which we're going to talk about levels of health intervention so that we can understand the rescue versus social determinants of health versus social determinants of equity. So here we go. Do, 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 do. Whoops, boom. Somebody has just fallen off of the cliff of good health or the cliff of being home secure or whatever. Somebody is at the bottom of that cliff, and if that were you, or somebody in your family, you would be delighted to find an ambulance there at the bottom of the cliff to speed you to care, or a home, a shelter to take you in for the night. But if we're thinking about other people who may come along that cliff face, if we're thinking about population health or public health or community health, we might well ask ourselves, what do we need to put in place besides just stationing lots of ambulances at the bottom of the cliff? So somebody could say, I know, let's put a net halfway down, right? To keep people from getting crunched at the bottom, even if they've fallen. And that's really good, but we all recognize that nets have holes in them. So some people may fall through the cracks. So we could even make that a trampoline halfway down. No holes in a trampoline. But even if that were a trampoline halfway down that cliff, you might find yourself with lots of people just bouncing up and down at half functionality, not able to get back to the top of the cliff. So what else could we put in place as a health intervention? Well, we could certainly think about putting a fence at the edge of the cliff to keep people from falling in the first place. But that has got to be a very, very strong fence if there's a lot of population pressure against it. So what else can we put in place as a health intervention? We can think about moving the population away from the edge of the cliff. So I'm going to label these interventions so far, and here I'm speaking from health interventions, but as we're thinking about homelessness and home insecurity, it's the same thing in terms of the systems to address those. So in the health sector, that ambulance represents medical care and tertiary prevention. Public health people talk about primary, secondary, tertiary prevention. Tertiary prevention is preventing the complications from disease that's already manifest. The net or trampoline halfway down, these are our safety net programs and secondary prevention, which is about early detection or screening. The fence represents primary prevention, keeping things from happening in the first place, and moving the population away from the edge of the cliff is about addressing the social determinants of health, like poverty, neighborhood conditions, educational opportunities, and the like. So if we're thinking about homelessness and home insecurity, the ambulance is a shelter. The net might be temporary housing with family, crowding, in terms of families. The fence, well, maybe this is going to be providing some job training and all for vets, for example, that kind of thing. And moving the population away from the edge of the cliff is making sure that we don't have a lot of poor vets, unemployed vets, that we have a living wage in place, that neighborhood conditions and the like are conducive, that we have affordable housing in our communities that is of high quality. Now, this is a nice little cliff, and we could talk about where do we want to put our interventions, and I think anybody going into a community or going into an agency that has resources and say, where should we put our resources, people would agree we basically need some of all of it, but it's a matter of emphasis, and I myself would emphasize moving the people away from the edge of the cliff, but so far this diagram, as useful as it is, as a thought inducer or a communication tool, has a fatal flaw because it doesn't yet talk about how health disparities arise or how housing disparities arise. So in, with regard to health, I'm going to leave the cliff in the back of the mind, talk about how health disparities arise on three levels, and then we'll come back to the cliff. So how do health disparities arise, and especially when you're talking about racial ethnic health disparities? Well, unfortunately, we have lots of evidence about differences in the quality of care received within the healthcare system. I'm not familiar, and I know other speakers will talk about the availability of housing types of resources in that system. That was the Institute of Medicine in 2002 pulling together hundreds of studies. We have thousands of studies now documenting differences in the quality of care, even if you are in the same system with the same insurance. But of course, there's another level, which is getting access to care in the first place, right? That's the second level at which health disparities arise. And even before you're sick enough or threatened with homelessness enough, there are differences in our life opportunities, exposures, and stresses that are making some of us more vulnerable than others in the first place. And actually, when you think about these three levels at which disparities arise, differences in quality, differences in access, and differences in underlying exposures and opportunities, it's like a big pyramid, or better yet, an iceberg with a huge hidden base of the differences in the quality of our lives. Then you have sicker people or more vulnerable people who are the same ones who have challenges in accessing the systems of care. And then sometimes those very ones who are lucky enough to get into the systems of care are further injured because of differences in quality. So thinking about those three levels at which health disparities arise and other disparities arise, we're not going to go back to the cliff. But now we're going to recognize that, in fact, we're not dealing with a flat, two-dimensional cliff, but actually we are dealing with a three-dimensional cliff. And at some parts of the cliff, there might be an ambulance there, but that ambulance has a flat tire. So it's slower, goes off in the wrong direction. Or maybe there's no ambulance there at all, and maybe there's no net nor fence, and usually at those parts of the cliff, the population is being pushed closer to the edge. So now I'm going to label these observations about our three-dimensional cliff with how health disparities arise, where the differences in quality of care, that's when the ambulance is there, but it's slower, goes off in the wrong direction. Differences in access to care, no ambulance, no net, no fence. Differences in underlying exposures and opportunities, the closer proximity of that population to the edge. So now we have a different set of questions to ask. Because actually, you know, I talked about moving the population away from the edge of the cliff as addressing the social determinants of health. But now that we recognize that we're dealing with a three-dimensional cliff, we need to ask other questions. How did the cliff become three-dimensional? That's usually through historical injustices that are being perpetuated through present-day contemporary structural factors. And given that it's three-dimensional, why are there differences in how resources are distributed along the cliff face? And why are there differences in who's found at different parts of the cliff? Why are the orangies back here in the way and the greenies being pushed closer to the edge? And when you start asking these questions and addressing these issues, you're now doing what I describe as addressing the social determinants of equity, in contrast to the social determinants of health. And the social determinants of equity include systems of power that have the power to distribute resources and populations like racism and sexism and heterosexism and the like. All of these isms, which are actually, I could talk for days, and I know I don't have time to talk for days. But that's what I'm talking about, as opposed to the context, which are the social determinants of health, like neighborhood conditions and poverty and the like. So I've actually distilled three different dimensions of health intervention on this cliff. And you think about three dimensions. One dimension is a line, two dimensions is a flat plane, three dimensions is space. Along that first dimension, we can actually talk about health services or homelessness services, where you can have your ambulance, net, and fence displayed along a line at the edge of the fence of the cliff. But we recognize no matter how good those services are that we put in place, and no matter if we even had universal access, for example, to high-quality health care, which we all want because we value all of our people equally, that's what a civilized society does, but even if we did, if there are a lot of people crowded against the edge of that, against that fence, we will overwhelm whatever system we put in place. So we have to move into the second dimension. We must address the social determinants of health like poverty and neighborhood conditions. If we're going to have large and sustained improvements in health outcomes, we have to move the population away from the edge of the cliff. But you know what? We could actually move some of the population away from the edge of the cliff and not all of the population if we don't recognize that we're dealing with a three-dimensional cliff. And we could make health disparities worse. So we must also acknowledge and address the social determinants of equity, including racism, sexism, heterosexism, and the like, if we're going to achieve social justice and eliminate health disparities. So that is the cliff. Now I want to very quickly hone in on one of the social determinants of equity, racism, which is where my work is focused, which certainly is producing a lot of homelessness and home insecurity through the overrepresentation of people of color in poverty, through what's happening with our vets who many, you know, we have a volunteer army, so many people of color are going into that as a way and then coming back and not getting the services they need. So we could talk about that during the question and answer for a long time. But let me go to racism and define it for you. What is racism? I am very clear that I'm talking about a system when I say the word racism. I'm not talking about an individual character flaw or a personal moral failing or even a psychiatric illness, as some people have suggested. But I'm talking about a system of power, and it's a system of doing what? It's a system of structuring opportunity and of assigning value. And on what basis is that opportunity structured, and on what basis is the value assigned? It's based on the social interpretation of how we look, which is what we call race. So you look at me in Georgia, where I am in Atlanta, I'm clearly black. If you were to look at me in some parts of Brazil, I would be just as clearly white. If you were to look at me in South Africa, I would be clearly colored. So here I would be with the same physical appearance, but the social interpretation of my physical appearance would assign me to three different racial groups in those settings. And if I were to stay in any of those settings long enough, then my health outcome would probably take on that of the group to which I've been assigned, even though I'd have the same genes in all three places. Now, what are the impacts of this system of structuring opportunity and assigning value based on so-called race, based on the social interpretation of how we look? Well, racism unfairly disadvantages some individuals and communities. And when we think or talk about racism in this society at all, this is where we go. But it doesn't take very long to recognize that every unfair disadvantage has its reciprocal unfair advantage, so that racism is also unfairly advantaging other individuals and communities. And that's the whole issue of unearned white privilege that we hardly ever talk about in this society. But then now, even as we recognize that we have a system that's either unfairly disadvantaging or unfairly advantaging individuals and communities, racism is sapping the strength of our whole society through the waste of human resources. And I don't have time to tell you a lot of examples, but a clear example of that is how we in this country are still not investing vigorously in the excellent public education of all of our kids, because the blinders of racism have made us differentially value our children and have made us believe there is no genius there in the barrios or in the ghettos or on the reservations, that we can get along very well, thank you, without those kids. But of course, there is genius in all of our communities. And if we were to invest in that genius, we could be doing so much better as a nation or even as a world. We might be up on Mars farming already if that were a good idea. Okay. So we could have a lot of discussion about this. But I think that this point about how racism saps the strength of the whole society is actually an important point. And any of you all who were at the opening general session, I felt that the warmth of other suns, when she was telling the people who would not have been what they were had not for the great migration of African Americans from the South, a light bulb went off. I said, this is the story we need to tell. This is how I can talk about how racism saps the strength of all of us, because that's the potential that was realized because of a change. Anyway, that definition that I just gave you of racism can be generalized to be a definition of any structured inequity. So what is sexism? It's a system of structuring opportunity and assigning value based on gender that unfairly disadvantages some, unfairly advantages others, and saps the strength of the whole society through the waste of human resources. And there are many axes of inequity going on in our nation, race, gender, ethnicity, et cetera, et cetera. And all of these, okay, thank you. All of these are risk markers for how opportunity is structured and how value is assigned. And maybe a few of them are actually risk factors in the pathway, but they're all risk markers. I focus my work on race as an axis of inequity and racism as a system because it's foundational in our nation's history, and yet many people are in denial of its continued existence. But I recognize that all of this is going on at the same time in communities and even intersecting in individuals. So now I'm going to close. I have 5 more minutes, and I think that I could do this in 5 minutes. I have three quick allegories on race and racism that I actually first presented in a TED talk, a TEDx talk. So if you want to find these again, TEDx Emory in April. And so these three stories are tools that are quick enough that I hope you remember them and pass them on, because it is hard to talk about race and racism, but I think that these will help us. And also for those who don't know my Gardner's Tale allegory, and I don't know if we'll have time in the question and answer to tell that, okay, then we could look that up too. The first of these stories, Japanese Lanterns, Color Perceptions. This story comes from my real-life experience when I was studying medicine in California. I was invited to a garden party, and the garden was beautifully decorated with Japanese lanterns and colored light bulbs, and the night was falling, and I'd been chitting and chatting and enjoying conversation, but I got a little tired, so I decided to retire to one corner of the garden. And as I'm just sitting there listening to the conversation flowing over me, I looked up, and I became fascinated by a group of pink moths. And I'm almost doing a meditation on these moths. And then I looked over and I noticed a group of green moths and a little further on a group of blue moths. And now the scientist in me is very excited because I was like, wow, look at that. And look how they are sorting according to their kind. So now you guys are like, Kamara, really? Did you really think that? Well, I did. I did for a minute. But what you know is that I could have looked at another part of the garden and been talking about yellow or purple or orange moths. And because you have experience seeing moths under universal light, you know there's no such thing as any of these colors of moths. Moths are different colors. But they're different colors of brown and tan and speckled and splotched. But we can only know that if we see them under a universal light that allows for all possibilities. And in fact, the colors that I thought I saw and the colors that we think we see in society are actually due to the lights by which we look. And these colored lights are actually distorting and masking our own true variability. So this got me thinking about what is race and how do the racial categories that we construct distort our understanding of our own full humanity. So race is clearly a social classification, not a biologic descriptor. And it's the social interpretation, as I said before, of how one looks in a race-conscious society. And if you're in a society that structures the racial lights as red, pink, and blue, you know, the black, white, Latino, other, then that's what you're going to see. If you're in a different society, you're going to see by different lights. So that's the first story. The second image also comes from when I was a medical student. Now here I am. I've been studying late with some friends, and we were hungry. So we walk into Palo Alto looking for some food. We find a restaurant. We walk into the restaurant. We sit down. We order our food. The food is served, and we are eating. Here we are. And it's not a remarkable story yet, but as I was sitting there eating, I looked up, and I noticed a sign. And the sign was a big aha to me about racism. So you're wondering, what did the sign say? The sign said open. And here I was, sitting at the table of opportunity, eating, with a sign that proclaimed open to me. No big deal, except I knew something about the two-sided nature of those signs, and I realized that, in fact, now the restaurant was closed due to the hour, and that hungry people just a few feet away from me, but on the other side of that sign, would not be able to just come on, sit down, and eat. And I realized that racism structures open-closed signs in our society, that racism structures a dual reality where for those who are inside, they may not even realize that there's a two-sided sign going on. It is difficult for any of us to recognize a system of inequity that privileges us. It is difficult for men to recognize male privilege and sexism. It is difficult for white people in this country to recognize white privilege and racism. It is difficult for all Americans to recognize our American privilege in the global society, except now with Ebola, maybe we get it a little bit. Right? Okay? But those on the outside are very well aware of the two-sided nature of the sign because it proclaims closed to them, and yet they can look through the window and see people eating. Back inside, I acknowledge that it is hard to really know, is there really a two-sided sign? Does racism really exist? It's hard to know that when you only see open. And in fact, it's a privilege not to have to know. But once you do know, you can choose to act. It doesn't compel you to act, but you have more information and you can choose to act. And so actually, knowing is empowering. It's not scary. You can say to the restaurant owner who's closer to you, open up the door, you'll make more money. There are hungry people outside. Or you can push some food through the door or help break down the glass or whatever you choose to do. But you won't be sitting there wondering, why don't those people just come on in and sit down and eat? Because you'll understand something about the two-sided nature of the sign. So that gets us back to our definition of racism and how it disadvantages some and advantages others. The last story, and usually I talk, but I know this thing is, I mean, I walk when I do this one, but I know we're being taped. So, okay, you're going to have to just see me walking here behind this podium. This image comes not from my own real life experience, but from an image in the book by Beverly Daniel Tatum, Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria? And Other Conversations About Race. And Dr. Tatum is currently the president of Spelman College. So I'm going to take an image from her book, and I'm going to expand it to make it a story about becoming actively anti-racist. Now, in her book, she talks about racism as being a passive process, that people are just, you know, living their lives, going to school, going to work, their kids, they're just moving. I'm sorry, I'm going to have to just move away from the mic because we've been doing this here. And I don't even have a clicker. I don't know how I'm going to do it. But anyway, so here we are. Here we are on the conveyor belt, just living our lives, going to work, going to school, moving through racism inexorably and for racism always, because that's how the system is set up. So here we are, part of racism, but we're not trying to be part of racism. We're just trying to have a family and have a job and raise our kids. That's because racism is most often passive, most often shows up as inaction in the face of need. So I am almost out of here. What I said was racism is most often passive. The first step is naming racism. The second step is asking how is racism operating here. The third step is organizing and strategizing to act. So I've given you three allegories. Japanese lanterns on race as a social construct. Dual reality on racism is creating a two-sided sign, a dual reality, and life on a conveyor belt moving to action, urging all of us to become actively anti-racist, and by extension, actively anti all of these systems of structured inequity. Thank you very much.